safety concerns are another big element of what the workers are grieving on this. In fact, there was an interview with another employee at the facility who described the factory's toxic work environment by saying that when a coworker collapsed and died, they had us move the body and put in another coworker to keep the line going, which, I mean, it really strikes me as being a similar story that we've heard from production facilities for companies like Amazon over the past few years too. And so, yeah, just, you know, basic safety concerns for that environment. And then the final thing they're really pushing for is talking about how there's been a punitive attendance policy that managers have really been pushing, you know, cracking down on very minor attendance lapses.
I think, again, to reiterate on this show, it's not always just wages that these unions are complaining about. And I think when people have an idea of what a union is doing, a lot of times that's what they think. But in a lot of cases, there's a lot of reasonable demands on, you know, especially kind of uptime-based industries, you know, like a manufacturing, right? Discrete manufacturing, or in this case, you know, something more associated with food. So these things can get really complicated really quickly.
And if if this strikes you and you're interested in supporting these workers, the striking workers themselves have encouraged consumers to boycott products from Frito-Lay and Frito-Lay's parent company, PepsiCo. To support them, they're asking you to basically not purchase Frito-Lay, Pepsi, Gatorade, Starbucks, Lipton, Tropicana, and Stacy's products until a resolution or an agreement is in place to protect the members of the union and their families' financial livelihoods. So yeah, just keep that in mind. If you want to support them, you can certainly find out more from the union's website, but also just consider not buying Frito-Lay until this issue is resolved. And so with that, we will have to leave it. This is the end of our show for this month. Thank you so much for tuning in. Again, I have been Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Ellie Gilland.
We will see you next month. Have a great evening.
Baby, you understand me now.
Greetings and welcome to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding the institution of incarceration. We're here with Aliza Kaplan. So can you tell us about how you got involved with all this great work and projects and all kinds of different heinous laws that people are repudiating today?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a law professor at Lewis and Clark Law School, and I run the Criminal Justice Reform Clinic, which is a clinic I started about 6 years ago. And, you know, prior to that, I was an attorney and a professor on the East Coast. I'm from New York City, and I worked as an innocence lawyer for many years with the National Innocence Project and the New England Innocence Project. And then right before I came to Portland, I was teaching at Brooklyn Law School. And throughout all this time, I did a lot of innocence work and some immigration work. When I moved out to Portland and I was thinking about starting a clinic, I wanted to, you know, I thought about all the different types of issues that were relevant and important. And one of the things I really learned doing innocence work was that the folks that we help through these innocence projects around the country are, you know, just the tip of the iceberg. And there are so many people in our prisons that, you know, need lawyering, support, information. And I actually became interested in doing more of what we call back-end work. So similar to the work of the Innocence Project, sort of helping people at that place in their cases or in their lives where everyone, like they've been through the legal system already, but not necessarily focusing on innocence. So, over the first couple years of the clinic, we tried to figure out, you know, where was our place. And I guess luckily, although also unluckily, there was so much room for sort of an advocacy clinic to work on both direct representation. We do clemency, we do parole, we have a project in the youth incarceration system. We do a collaboration with a local organization called the Forensic Justice Project, sort of looking back at cases that involve forensic science and more, right? And do a lot of studies and reports because we're an educational institution. We work a lot on legislative efforts and stuff as well. And the majority of our work is what I call that back end work, where people really have lost hope that people can help them. And we want to do our best to help folks in those positions. So for example, we represent people in clemency cases before the governor, asking her to commute them to let them out of prison early. And we've been really successful with that. We represent individuals in our parole system. The way our parole system works is people who have committed serious crimes like murder have, if they were convicted during a certain time in our history, then they have this opportunity to go to the parole board. And so we represent people in those hearings with the hope of getting them out of prison at, you know, at the time of their parole hearing. And law students are a huge part of all of this work and representing people. We also have this program in the Oregon Youth Authority for all incarcerated youth, where we provide what I call legal navigation and information, mostly all about all their back end options, like, you know, how to do their appeals and post-conviction and pretty much anything that they need help with legally. We can try to do the research for them, help them advocate for themselves, or connect them to lawyers that can do that for them. And so, you know, we have all these different projects going. And what we learn from our projects is what leads us to make choices about what kind of reform that we want to do. So, you know, an example is we've had this pretty amazing clemency project for the last 5 or 6 years. And we learned that when we are successful in granting someone a pardon, that their conviction didn't even really come off their record, which was the whole goal of getting a pardon in the first place. So we decided to go to the legislature and change that. And we did in 2019, you know? And so our representation of some folks in pardon cases taught us sort of what was needed. And then we were able to help draft a bill and bring it to the legislature. This year, we worked on a really important bill, Senate Bill 819, and that directly came out of our work. This is a bill that allows district attorneys and defendants and their lawyers to go back into court in the interest of justice. And that could be anything from a wrongful conviction to someone who is just fully rehabilitated to someone with, you know, disproportionately long sentence, maybe based on race, or it could be someone that has serious medical concerns. You know, we learned over the last year that we don't have avenues for release for people who are medically vulnerable. So, you know, as we're learning from our individual cases, it directs us to want to make changes and reforms or to study an issue more in-depthly. So that's a long explanation of all the sort of ways we work in the clinic. We have a lot of projects, a lot of cases going. Probably one of our biggest projects this year that I didn't mention because it's a temporary project is something called the Ramos Project, which is all about non-unanimous juries here in Oregon. And that's an issue the clinic has been involved in for 7 or 8 years, or 6 or 7 years, who knows, I don't remember exactly. Feels like forever. And we played a very large part in changing the law at the U.S. Supreme Court level. The clinic was involved. Research that I had done a few years back sort of uncovered the racist history of the law in Oregon. I've worked hand in hand with folks in Louisiana, the only other state that had this law, to reach the Supreme Court in Ramos versus Louisiana. And in 2020, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the racist, horrible law as unconstitutional. And so the past year, we've been working to help folks who have non-unanimous juries submit cases, asking for their cases to be considered under Ramos. And there's a lot of different crazy legal issues and cases and things going on that issue as well.
Well, for anybody who probably hasn't ever heard of it, and there's probably plenty of people, and that includes nationally too, but then for us folks here in the state of Oregon, don't realize maybe what those origins are. So can you give a little bit more context about exactly what it is, and again that kind of deep history that now is getting a lot more unpacked very well, but for so much time is kind of shrouded in Oregon's racist history.
Yeah, sure. So non-unanimous juries, so Oregon and Louisiana were the only two states that had non-unanimous juries. And that meant for more than 85 years here in Oregon and more than 100 years in Louisiana, 150 years in Louisiana, people could be convicted of a crime, of felonies, so serious crimes, with a jury of 10 to 2. So only 10 people had to convict you or say think you're guilty, and the other two could think you were innocent or think the government didn't prove their case. So for all of these years, people were convicted of 10 to 2, 11 to 1, and it really flies in the face of everything we think a jury should be. I remember when I moved here 10 years ago being shocked, and I work in criminal law, and I never even knew about this. And I think that if you ask anyone walking down the street in Oregon, unless they've had interaction or been in the criminal justice system or sat on a jury, I don't think that anyone knew about this either. And that was what I was finding, because when I found out, I was shocked. And usually when I see or hear about an injustice or learn about one, the first thing I want to do, probably because I'm an academic, is figure out how did this happen? What's the history? How did we get here? So I figured, it was 2016 or something, I figured, or 2015, someone must have done the research on this already. And I started Googling around and talking to folks in Louisiana. And there was a book of someone who did a really in-depth dive in Louisiana at the history. And there wasn't anything like that in Oregon. I started researching with my law students, and we learned pretty quickly, just from the media of the day, this is in 1933, that this law came into effect sort of as a reaction to a criminal trial at the time that took place in Columbia County. And it was a murder case of a Jewish man who was a gangster. There was a lot of undercover gangster type gang stuff happening in Portland back in those days. And this man was put on trial for the murder of two people, and the jury couldn't reach a decision. And over the months of the trial, leading up to it, during jury deliberations, all the local papers and even some of the papers outside of the area covered this. Mostly, you could see a lot of what was happening through what we called the Morning Oregonian then, and that's the Oregonian today. And they covered this trial like every single thing. It was like a big deal, and they. People were glued to it. I don't know what the equivalent would be today, but to me, it reminds me of like the O.J. Simpson trial in the 90s. Everyone just glued and paying attention and coverage of every aspect of it. And there was a lot of editorializing in the Morning Oregonian and other papers in the state about the jury and very direct xenophobia towards Catholics and Jews and Asians, about how they come from countries that could never understand democracy and we shouldn't let them make decisions. And it was just like one after the other. You could see this in the newspaper's coverage. And in the end, they couldn't get a conviction. So they settled on manslaughter and a fine. And people were outraged. And like so many laws, especially in criminal law, the very, very intense reaction led to us changing the law. And there was a special election, a referral that put non-unanimous juries into our constitution. So it constitutionalized this. It wasn't just a new law. And when something's in the Constitution, you can't just pass another law necessarily to get rid of it, right? So that became the law in 1934 in direct response to this murder trial. It was mentioned in the voters' ballot, I mean, the voters' pamphlet. And there was very little opposition. And it was seeped in sort of the racism of the time. And, you know, that's been documented now and proven through my historical work on this. And then what you've seen over the 85 years is how this law has played out. And just like every aspect of our criminal justice system here in Oregon, the law has disproportionately affected people of color. And the other piece that I think gets lost sometimes in this is how it affects jurors. So imagine if you were on a jury and, you know, nobody cared what you thought or, you know, you could vote and it wouldn't matter, right? It really, not only if one or two people on your jury doesn't think the person committed the crime or that the state didn't prove their case, not only does that create reasonable doubt, which is, you know, the legal standard in criminal cases, but imagine if you were the one person of color on the jury that might be there in Oregon because of our demographics alone, right? Imagine if your voice wasn't heard. I mean, none of us want our voice to be silenced in that kind of environment, but imagine if you were the only person of color on the jury, and this has happened over and over again as well. So even though there's no like legal claim for that, it just shows, or no one's brought a legal claim for that, it just shows how troubling the law is, not just for a defendant's rights, but also for jurors.
For folks just tuning in, we are here at Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBO Portland, and we're here with Aliza Kaplan, Professor of Lawyering and Director of Criminal Justice Reform at Lewis and Clark in the Portland, Oregon area, and we're talking about, again, old racist laws in Oregon and how that affects juries. So can you elaborate now where it's moving from the national front now back here in Oregon, and what needs to have to happen, and how is that being done?
So on April 20th, 2020, the United States Supreme Court found that non-unanimous juries, that they're unconstitutional. You cannot convict people based on non-unanimous juries. So yay. At the time that happened, Louisiana had already voted by ballot measure to get rid of theirs. So we were really the only state left that this ruling directly affected. And so at that moment, when that ruling came down on April 20th, 2020, anyone that did not have a final judgment in their case. So if you were convicted by non-unanimous jury and you had just filed your appeal, but the appeal process hadn't completed for you, you got stopped in your tracks, your case, and your case gets automatically sent back to the county to start over. Right. And there was about 400 people over the last year that have been discovered that they were in that position, and they go back to get a redo or to settle the case, or the case gets dropped, or they have a new trial or whatever. That's automatic. The issue that we've all been talking about for the last year, however, are the people who had final judgments. So that causes a whole other issue, right? So people with non-unanimous juries who have already been through all of their appeals process, are in a position where the law, and our attorney general has been arguing under federal law, that they don't have a right to retroactivity. And this was confirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court this last May in another opinion called Edwards versus Vinoy. They said that under the federal retroactivity doctrine, there's no retroactivity for non-unanimous juries. But all these people, less than 300, but still most of them in prison, have filed claims saying, hey, what about me? I want my constitutional trial also. And they all filed over the last year after Ramos came out, and their cases are all at different stages of filing, or, you know, going to trial or just filed. You know, that's been happening all year. And the attorney general is the respondent in those cases. And all of those cases, she has said, no retroactivity, no, you don't have retroactivity, you don't have retroactivity. And now the U.S. Supreme Court has said, under the federal standard, there's no retroactivity. So she's arguing now she has the support of the U.S. Supreme Court on that. And where are we? So where are we is that for the last year, less than 300 people have brought claims asking for that redo, that new trial, to go back to the beginning because they were convicted by an unconstitutional jury system and a racist one. And she's been fighting every single one of them. And now the Supreme Court has made this big ruling. However, the Supreme Court also said very clearly in this recent opinion, Edwards, that states are free to not follow this legal standard. States are free to apply their own retroactivity standard under state law. And so first, our Attorney General, the fact that she continuously is fighting these people is incredibly disappointing. She could, with her power as the Attorney General, this whole year, she could have been stipulating to retroactivity. She could be not fighting against every person, every case. Unfortunately, that's not what she's done. Now, where are we? We're in a position where the issue is going to either be decided by the Oregon Supreme Court in the next few years, whether these people deserve retroactive application of Ramos and get that redo, that new trial, or perhaps our legislature will act before that happens. And we have a couple weeks left of this legislative session. There's probably going to be a special session in September on some other issues. And then we have a short session that starts in February. So because so many people are sitting in prison with these unconstitutional convictions, you know, and we can, and the Attorney General has just so dug in and refuses to use her discretion, my great hope is that our legislature ASAP picks this up and passes some language or a bill that would allow folks with the ability to prove that they were convicted with a non-unanimous jury, allow them to have their cases vacated and sent back to the beginning. And I just want to be really clear, nobody is asking for the prison doors to be open and people be running out. This isn't about this. This is about unconstitutional procedure that was used, and in any other state and the federal government, these people would have been acquitted or mistrialed. So, you know, they would not have been convicted. So all they're asking is to go back to the beginning and have that opportunity. They're not asking just to be released without, you know, the district attorneys in those counties will have an opportunity to look at each case individually and make the best decision for that case.
Right. Well, I mean, kind of speaking of the prison doors literally not just kind of opening right up, yeah. Then it's been the opposite, and probably I don't know if we could say it's the worst in U.S. history in prisons or not as far as lockdowns with COVID. At the least, though, it's just such a major factor in everything and how it's jammed up everything, and also how it's led to more increased human rights violations inside and legal constitutional rights violated inside, and the political repression and cultural oppression that's happening within that whole cycle. Can you talk more about kind of how that landscape is affecting a lot of these different issues that you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, the COVID crisis in prison is, as far as I know, unprecedented. That's in Oregon, but everywhere in this country. You know, thousands of prisoners around the country got ill and died. You know, every time anyone talked, you know, even casually about lockdown, all I thought about was all of my clients and all the people that are in prison, because, you know, they're in prison already, and then they're locked down. They were not able to like FaceTime and order food to their house. You know, like they were in many instances and for many months just in their cells, you know, and with no programming, with no visitation. And that's still going on in some of our prisons. They're just slowly opening up and doing pilot programs around the state at the different prisons. So people are just slowly starting to be able to see loved ones and their lawyers and everything. But, you know, I just think the situation was unprecedented. I think there was some help from the governor's office. I think she, in the end, released about a little bit over 1,000 people just based on COVID and people with medical vulnerabilities, which in comparison to many states was wonderful. Obviously, many more could have been released because of COVID. And I think that, you know, one of the really hardest parts was the incredible lack of information people were getting. Think about the first months of COVID and how scary it was. But, you know, you could still put on the TV or surf the web and look for stuff and, you know, sort of feed that need for information. And obviously there was none of that. So just, you know, prison is a horrible place already and scary. And, you know, the volume of all of that was turned up so incredibly high. And they were getting so much misinformation, and all of, you know, people's friends and cellmates and COs and everyone was getting sick. So, you know, I can't even imagine really what it was like during that time. And I think, like so many other issues in our society, the vulnerability of our prison population and how sort of sick it is was brought to light, you know, in the same way that our public health system was exposed. I definitely think that for people who weren't already familiar, a lot of what was going on in prisons around the country was really, really exposed. And, you know, I was really thankful when folks had the opportunity to get vaccinations, but also there's so much misinformation in the prisons about that. And so I think, you know, vaccinations and other types of care were used against people who were incarcerated. And yeah, I mean, I've encouraged all of my clients to get vaccinated. But, you know, it's there's a lot of misinformation in prisons anyway. And I think that in a huge crisis like this, it was, I think that was one of a really hard thing, extra hard thing, and really exposed the vulnerabilities of all of it, like it did in other aspects of society.
Yeah, and you mentioned there's some cases where there was some consideration about letting people out regarding health issues. Do you know what kind of frequency that looked like in cases, and was a lot of it related to compassionate release type issues or?
Yeah, so we have a really terrible, we don't have a good compassionate release, you know, avenue here in Oregon. Our avenue runs through our parole board. It's definitely was not created for a major health crisis. Even before COVID, we had been talking about how it needed to be changed. We have tried in my clinic to use the compassionate release process through the parole board, and it's nobody knows what's going on, really. And we had actually talked about it, not that, you know, with the Department of Justice about how it needed to be changed and we should start thinking about that. And then COVID hit, and I know we tried that avenue for that, and others did too, and there was no way. The legal standard is, and the process is just, you know, not meetable, really. So there wasn't an avenue there. So the only way in Oregon at the time, over the last year, for folks to be released early, it was through the governor's office. And so, you know, I think over the year, I think between the summer and I want to say like February, the governor came up with a criteria, and in groups, DOC with the governor's office were just automatically releasing people. And I think the final number, I got an email when the program ended in April, I think the number was close to, I don't know, 1100 or 1200 people. And, you know, so it was done in groups. And the one requirement was that folks had housing. So that, I think, was something that was important to the governor, that they not, you know, that they would have somewhere to go when they were released. And yeah, and that process was just going on month to month. I think she also did a year off of everyone who, any adult in custody who worked on the, as a firefighter during the wildfires. She took a year off of everyone's sentence. So some were released because of that, and others have that time taken off.
Great. So there's a lot of amazing resources we just talked about. And what are some takeaways for our listeners as far as resources? Maybe the best ones on Ramos' case. There's the Forensic
Justice Project. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, sure. So I would say for all Ramos non-unanimous jury issues, and to follow along with that campaign and figure out action items along the way, there's a website called stillinprison.org, and everything that gets updated regularly. for the Forensic Justice Project, which is the organization that the clinic, the Criminal Justice Reform Clinic at Lewis and Clark, collaborates with. There's also a website, and I want to make sure I get it right, but I think it's just forensicjusticeproject.org. Yeah, forensicjusticeproject.org to learn about the work that we do. And the Criminal Justice Reform Clinic, our website is at the Lewis and Clark Law School website, and you can just Google that and find out all about our projects. And then the other thing I always encourage folks to do is, you know, get involved in, whether it's to sign a petition like we're doing in the Still in Prison campaign, or whether it's to follow some of the legislation that's happening, you know, and make phone calls and talk to legislators. The one thing I'll say about Oregon is that things are possible, you know, not always when you want them or right away, but, you know, the more people that work on criminal justice reform issues, the more chance we have in making a real difference and making real change in our prison system and in our criminal justice system. And, you know, I'm really proud of the work that we do at the clinic, and we work with colleagues all over the state on a lot of these issues. So we welcome the interest, and join us.
All right. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Big thanks to our guests and Prison Pipeline Collective member Karen James for editing and production. Free them all.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second.